We are back in our course in ancient philosophy, and we just have one or two small items to add to our previous considerations of Aristotle's theory of reality. I wanted to call your attention to this quote from him because it sounds so odd to our modern ears. He says, "The first science, the most important one, deals with things that have independent existence and are changeless. Now, all causes must be eternal." There never was a time they didn't exist. And I called your attention to that. He even says that about species, since they're the products of the influence of eternal and independent forms on changeable matter. Species have always existed. So there have always been horses and daisies and human beings and so on. All causes are eternal, but especially the ones that are independent and changeless. For they are causes that operate on as much of the divine as appears to us. And you might think that sounds really weird. What do you mean the divine appears to us? But remember, his idea of divinity is that something is divine if it has independent existence, it doesn't depend on anything else, and it's changeless. And he links those two together. Not all thinkers did that. The definition that I argued for when we considered the definition of religious belief was that the divine is the whatever has independent existence and generates everything else. He'd accept that, but he would want to add, and it has to be changeless. It has to be, since it's pure form that we're talking about, that it never changes in any way. He says, then, there must be three theoretical philosophies, the three superior sciences. And what we call theology is one of them. Since if the divine is present anywhere, it's present in things of this sort. You might say, what in the world is he talking about? Where do we see divinity? And for Aristotle, the answer to that is, in the heavens at night, when you look at the stars, you see things that, as far as the ancient Greeks knew, never changed. There are things in the heavens that do change. The planets, for example, move around. You could track them. In fact, that's the Greek word. Our word planet comes from the Greek for wanderer. These are the things that wander around in the sky. The sun rises and sets. The moon rises and sets. So these things change. But the distant stars appear to them to be fixed and never move and never change. And so the Greeks referred to them as visible gods. They have independent existence and they don't change. So that's what he's talking about. He's actually talking about astronomy. And these fixed stars are as much of the divine as appears to us. There's more to it. The forms themselves are divine. The forms that result in every type of thing that fills creation. But we don't see them all by themselves. We see the imperfect things they give rise to. I just thought I'd clear that up in case you run across that quote in your reading and wonder what the places he's talking about. Will you see the divine? Yes, you do. So for them, there's no question that something is divine, all right. I said that there was no way to avoid that anyway. If you remember when we treated the issue of the definition of religious belief, I started with something self-existent. That's for sure. The question is what? And the religions all put something in that slot of being the self-existent reality that everything else depends on. They just disagree on what it is. And here, Aristotle's being as clear as he knew how to be. I thought that his comments might not be clear to you if you ran across them. So with that, we put to bed, for the time being, his theory of reality. I've had a number of objections to make to it. I've had pointed out a number of ways I don't think it succeeds in giving us the explanation that he sought and that anybody would. And we shift now to our last topic in Aristotle, which is his political theory. He wrote a book called The Politics, and it has a very famous opening. Every state is a community of some kind, and every community is established with a view to some good. For mankind always acts in order to obtain that which they think is good. But if all communities aim at some good, the state or political community, which is the highest of all, and which includes all the rest, aims at a good in a greater degree than any other, and at the highest good. There's a lot packed into that opening, and this is how the politics begins, and it may just be, the most influential political treatise ever written. It's certainly one of them. For a long time after this, Aristotle's Politics was taken as a guide by a great many people, and by a great many Christians, whom I'm going to argue should have known better than to follow him in some of his recommendations. But at any rate, it's important. The first important point to make about this is that the state, according to him, the political community, the political organization, the organization of society that makes the laws and enforces them, the organization of which government is the ruling body, that organization he calls the state. It's not the way we use the term in the U.S. for divisions of our country into states. The entire country would be a state, in Aristotle's opinion. This includes and embraces all other communities and therefore all individuals. And he goes on to tell us that individuals relate to the state as parts to the whole. Let me sketch that for you for in a moment. They're parts of the whole. Now, what does it mean to be a part of something? Well, Aristotle gives us three famous rules for telling when one thing is a part of another. First of all, a part cannot come into existence. Remember, backward capital E means exist in logic. Cannot come into existence without the whole. It cannot function apart from the whole. And it cannot be understood without the whole. And that's what he's saying is true of the relationship between individual people and the state they live in. They're parts of it. They can't come into existence without the broader group. It takes at least two people to make another person. It takes more than two people to be self-sustaining, and that's his definition of the state. He says what happens is that we have families come into existence, and families group together. And when that grouping together is able to be self-sustaining, it can support itself, it can defend itself, then you automatically have a state. So that's the definition of a state. A state is a community of families that is self-sustaining. Now, I think any Christian would have a serious reservation about some of this, particularly about humans being parts of the state. human beings are never just parts of anything. And it's important to notice that part-whole relationship isn't the only one in town. There's also the relation of sub-wholes to greater wholes. For example, water goes by the formula H2O, two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. You combine to make a water molecule. But the atoms that combine don't fit the definition for a part. It's not that they can't come into existence except by being water first and being broken down. It's not true that they can't function in other ways without being part of a water molecule. And it's not true that they can't be understood apart from their combination in a water molecule. So they fail all three of those tests. What we have in the case of H2O is hydrogen and oxygen atoms that are sub-wholes incorporated into a greater whole. And typically, whenever that happens, the new greater whole has properties we could never predict just from knowing its parts. And that is the kind of relationship, I would argue, that exists between individual human beings and a state or any other organization they're members of. They are sub-wholes, not mere parts. It's not that their existence depends entirely on this whole, and that they can't function or be understood apart from the whole. Now, Aristotle doesn't want to think that human beings could exist outside the state. He even has an argument for that, and he says in one place, the solitary individual dies. And in another place, he says that when families group together so as to be self-sufficient with respect to their needs, that's a natural thing for them to do, and therefore it automatically produces a state. Therefore, a state is a natural organization. It's a natural community. It arises just out of the nature of humans and the world that they live in. It's not artificial. It's not created arbitrarily because humans contract together to make it. It just arises. It grows up very naturally out of the needs of humans to preserve their lives. Now, that isn't at all the view that most of us are acquainted with. If we're citizens of any Western European country or North America, we tend to think more that individuals can exist on their own, and that they freely create a state, that they contract together to make the institution of government, and they go into detail, and maybe they write a constitution and set the government up. Or maybe the government's so old that it's been around before that they can remember who tried to form it. It didn't come about because people made an explicit agreement. It was a tacit agreement. And then the laws just sort of grew up and evolved out of everyday practice and court decisions, like the tradition of British common law. But we may think of it that way, but Aristotle's dead set against that. He is what we would call a collectivist. And that means that the group, the community, is in a sense more real than any individual member of it. Remember, it's the community of the state that is self-sufficient, not an individual. Remember his sales talk there, the solitary individual dies? Later on, he concedes that there may be unusual individuals who can live by themselves out of a state, outside of any state. Hermits or somebody, you know, people like that. But he thinks that's highly unusual. And he thinks one of two things: either that such a person is so far superior to the average human that they ought to live outside of the state, and they ought to live away from everybody else, or that person's life degrades to the point where they're a little more than an animal. Say, his way of putting it is, anyone capable of living on his own is either a god or an animal. I want you to think for a moment, since this is not in the background of most of my viewers, that most of you are not born and raised collectivists. You're born and raised individualists. You think the individual is the primary social reality, and that free and independent individuals contract together to invent a state. Well, why don't you think about what that would involve? Let's consider Aristotle's comment that, yeah, for the average person anyway, if you're solitary, you're not going to survive. Suppose you were cast up by a shipwreck onto some deserted island someplace. You weren't sure where you were. Now, to make this illustration really work, you have to understand that you're going to be cast up there with no tools, no clothes, no shoes on your feet, no weapon. The great novel that promoted individualism was Daniel Defoe's story of Robinson Crusoe. He's a modern European superior white male. He's cast up on a deserted island, and he not only survives, he prevails. The people who are native to the island see that he's so far superior that they make him leader. That story is just loaded with unbelievable things like that. Instead of having him for lunch, they make him their leader. Well, but Robinson Crusoe is cast up on the shore with clothes, shoes on his feet, and not only that, he's got a rifle, and the powder didn't get wet in the shipwreck. Can you imagine that? That's not what I'm asking you to envision. Envision yourself cast on an island and you don't have anything. What should you do first? Is the first thing that you need to find drinking water? If you do find water, do you know that it's drinkable? How are you going to tell that? Maybe it's polluted with something you can't see. Maybe it's inhabited by some kind of little parasites. If you drink it, they're going to eat your insides out. Or is the first thing to get something on your feet, even if that's just some tough kind of leaves tied on with vines? Is that how you should be spending your time? How do you know something isn't hunting you right now? Picked up your scent and is headed toward you. Maybe you need first a weapon. And what will that be? You have no tools to cut any branches. And suppose where you are, there are no trees. I think you can see that you're in tough shape. There's a lot to what Aristotle says about the solitary individual not being able to survive. It would take an unusual person. Now, we have shows on TV about people surviving in the wild, and the guy who always leads the expedition or takes the other tenderfoot out into the wild is an expert in that stuff. He's practiced with it. He knows all kinds of arcane information about what berries you can eat and what you can't, and how you might check water and how you might arrange for. But he's not cast out there with no equipment. He's got a rope, and he's clothed, and he has the right kind of boots, and he has. That's not a fair comparison. He's not alone. He has the accompaniment of all the products of a society, of a community, a broad community of people that produces nylon rope and waterproof boots and the insulated hat and whatever else he needs. Individualism is very unconvincing if you take it seriously. The individual alone can survive and prevail, is capable of existing and flourishing all by himself. That it looks false. And I think it is false. But we do not have to say, as Aristotle did, that humans are parts of a whole. It's not the case that we have to be mere parts that cannot be understood. Now my thing went away here. That we are mere parts. Remember, this is what I had. That cannot exist or function or be understood apart from the whole. No, I think that humans are sub-wholes to the whole, a greater whole, and that when you put them together in a group, a community like that, the community has things true of it that is not true of any member, sub-whole member. Now, the extreme individualists go so far as to deny that there are any such things as human communities. An extreme individualist, take Ayn Rand as an example. Ayn Rand has said, there are no communities, there are only individuals and the relationships between them. So there is no such thing in reality as a marriage, a family, a state, a business, a church, a school. There are no such things. There are just individuals and the relationships between them. That, however, is a self-contradictory objection. The relationships between them are the families, marriages, businesses, states, churches, schools, labor unions, political parties. There are all different kinds of relationships between them, and that's what a community is. So if the relationships between individuals are real, so are the communities. The objection doesn't succeed. It contains in itself the seeds of its own failure. The next thing we should notice about Aristotle's own theory is that when Greek families come together and form a community that's now self-sufficient, it's able to supply its needs, defend itself, automatically you have a state. Because what will happen is that there will arise rules, and there will be some protocol for enforcing the rules. Somebody will be a judge, for example, if for no other reason than that person has the kind of leadership charisma and displays a kind of wisdom in applying the rules, and so others accede to their judgment. When that sort of thing grows up, he says, it's different among Greeks from what it is among non-Greeks. Now, Aristotle has two sayings about this. One's common in ancient Greece, and that's the saying, it goes, if you're not a Greek, you're a barbarian. Me, Hellene, Barbaron. Not a Greek, you're a barbarian. And the second statement, which he quotes, barbarians are fit only to be the slaves of Greeks. If you want to peg where racism really gets its start in Western civilization and culture, I think you have to peg it right there. It's not merely that we do things well and we do them better. It's that we are just naturally superior to everybody else. That's the teaching. And Aristotle had a famous student that he tutored who listened to all of that and took it quite seriously. That student was Alexander the Great, and he decided to prove it, to take an army out and conquer all the barbarians. And at its greatest extent, Alexander's empire covered more territory than the Roman Empire did at its zenith. It's Alexander went all the way into India in the east. So this stuff is not just trivial. We have a succession of teachers. Socrates is concerned with standards and virtues and what is right and wrong. And he inspires Plato, who writes a whole theory of reality, attempts to do a theory of knowledge, and has also a theory about the state and right and wrong. We saw that. And then Plato teaches Aristotle, and Aristotle teaches Alexander. And as a result, you get a Greek empire that stretches over the known civilized world. Well, I won't belabor this point, but a lot of things that get their start here with Aristotle are continued in Western European civilization culture. The idea that a superior person doesn't work. Aristotle points out that pursuing the liberal arts, by that he means all the subjects that anybody might be interested in, the liberal arts are the arts that a liberal man pursues. And what's a liberal man? A liberal man is a man wealthy enough that he doesn't have to work for a living. And that's what frees him to pursue literature, plays, poetry, astronomy, mathematics, whatever interests him. Maybe what interests him is sports, and he pursues that, and he attends all the Olympic Games. It doesn't matter. The point is, the superior man is one who doesn't work. And that became the standard belief in Western European culture because it was taken over by the Romans as well. The superior person doesn't work. Aristotle even goes so far as to say that if a person does manual labor, then they're not able to think as well. So the plebes here who do all the work in the mines or harvest the crops or stamp out the grape juice for the wine or make the clothes or whatever it is, they probably aren't capable of doing philosophy. But the children of the wealthy, those we can tutor. It's worth spending the time with them. Now, I don't want to leave, however, this issue of Aristotle's collectivism. I started with that. It's the collective that is the basic reality. Now, this might sound like a joke if it weren't so serious. Which is the basic social reality? Individuals, and they freely form all the groups, so the groups are secondary, they depend on the individuals. Or is it the group, because the group only is self-sufficient, and it produces individuals that can survive because of the protection of the group, so the collective, the state, is the more basic reality, and individuals depend on that. Aristotle definitely takes the second point of view. It's the collective. And when people rebelled against that, finally, in the history of Western European culture, when they finally rebelled against it, they rebelled against it by becoming individualists. So they went from saying the collective is the basic social unit to individuals are the basic social unit. And they freely create whatever communities or collective groups, and this is called the contract theory when it's applied to how governments arose. This is the contract theory of government. What should a Christian say about this? Which is the basic social unit? Which one creates the other? And it seems to me that a Christian view of this is to denounce both sides. Neither one is the truth. It's not the case that the collective group creates the individuals or that the individuals create the collective group, because God created both, and he created both simultaneously. He created humans in relationship to one another. we have a psalm that says God places individuals in families. Neither of those is the source of the other, because God's the source of both of them. And neither of those theories should be acceptable to a Christian. Now, you say, well, why are you making such a big deal over it? So what if I'm a collectivist or an individualist? And, you know, I've been thinking that way for a long time. But I believe in God. I know Christ. But the very idea of justice gets bent by whether you're a collectivist or an individualist. And that's because the idea of justice will favor one or the other depending on what you are. Here's Aristotle, in his own words. The best governments are those in which the law is supreme. He takes that from Plato's last dialogue, The Laws. We saw Plato saying that. So what is justice? He says, now what is just or right is to be interpreted in the sense of what is equal. The government treats everyone equally. And that which is right in the sense of being equal is to be considered with reference to the advantage of the state and the common good of all the citizens. So the very idea of justice is equal treatment, but whatever favors the state. That's a collectivist view. The state is the primary reality. It's what individuals depend on. Therefore, justice is what preserves the state. Individualists have turned it around, said no, individuals are the primary reality. Therefore, the Constitution or the laws of the state must guarantee individual rights and rights as over against the state, things the state may not or should not try to do or order them around concerning. We want individual freedom. And so they want to see the idea of justice skewed to favoring the individual. If neither one is the source of the other, it takes away both those arguments. And justice is a kind of equality, but there's more to it than that. Justice has three parts. What we could call tributive justice, seeing that someone gets what they deserve, not just punishment, but reward. There's also distributive justice. We distribute goods as they're needed. Distributive justice means that the fire truck goes to my neighbor's house because that's the one that's on fire. And I can't sit there and say, well, I paid just as much in taxes. Why didn't they come visit me? Well, my house wasn't on fire, that's why. And then there's proportional justice. There are some things that need to be portioned out, goods or services. That's I think the chief idea of that is triage in medical treatment. If there's a disaster, medical workers arrive on the scene, they treat the most severely injured first and the lesser injured second. That's a kind of proportion in dealing out, dispensing the care. Those are all different sides to justice. But it must be equal then, and it must not favor the state or the individual. The idea is that justice is the administration of fair laws even-handedly. So we view what favors individuals, what favors the state, as favoritism to be avoided. It is up to government to treat all its citizens as nearly equally as it possibly can. So this collectivist versus individualist infects the very idea of justice. You see it happening in Aristotle explicitly. He then says that from the moment of birth, some people are cut out to be slaves, and some people are cut out to be masters. That's the next big claim. How does that one grab you? Remember, in Plato's ideal state, the guardians were going to pick the people who looked like they had leadership abilities and intelligence, and they were going to rule. Aristotle leaves it that the people who hold the offices of government, which is the ruling body in the state, be elected by the citizens of the state. But, he says, it is still true. Plato had something right. From the moment of birth, we can see that some people are leaders and they're intelligent, and others are followers. Now, that's a much kinder way to put it than masters and slaves, but it gets a little closer to what he has in mind. Some people have leadership abilities. They're able to frame a plan. Confronted with a difficulty, they devise a plan. But they can't carry the plan out all by themselves. Somebody else has to join them and be the workers who implement the plan. That's what he has in mind. And he says this is a natural kind of slavery. It's not the kind where one person sells another and then beats them if they don't work hard enough. He's not thinking of that. He says, in fact, that masters and slaves should be friends, and that in the same household they work together for the good of the household, and they enjoy the fruits of their labor together. So he's not thinking of the stereotypical idea of slavery, say, in the southern part of the United States in the 19th century prior to the Civil War, and families broken up and sold, and people treated as though they were just nothing but instruments to be used and thrown away and so on. That's not the kind of slavery he has in mind. He goes on to say, and this is here he differs from his teacher Plato, that the husband-wife relationship is also a master-slave relation. He thinks men are of greater intelligence. They can plan. Women need to follow. Remember, Plato said, we will have women guardians. We take the talent where it comes. Whoever is bright and has leadership abilities, they're a guardian. They're in the upper class. Aristotle reverts to what had been the common opinion in ancient Greece and goes back to viewing even a marriage as a kind of master or leader-follower relationship. I think it's very clear what the Christian religion has to say about that, because it's in Galatians 3 that Paul says there's now no longer any difference between Greek, Jew or Greek, between slave or free, male or female, all are one in Christ. Because all are equal before God with respect to God's covenantal promises, because all are part of the body of Christ, all equally participate in family, state, church. I think that's what that teaches us. So I find it peculiar, put it that way, that some churches are very hesitant about whether women can be leaders in the church. I think the early church did exactly that. They ordained women, they gave them positions of leadership if they had the ability. Same as a man. Aristotle then lists the needs of a state. What do you have to have for the families to become a self-sufficient community? And he names food, arms, revenue, but he also includes arts. Now, that doesn't just mean what we call the fine arts. It doesn't mean they sit around, paint pictures, or make sculptures, and so on. Any kind a specific skill is what he's calling an art. So if someone is good at making houses, that's an art. Someone else is good at making clothes. Someone else good at making weapons. Someone else writes poetry. They're all called arts, as far as Aristotle is concerned. You become initiated into this this field, and you learn a trade, you learn a craft, and you learn to do something useful. That's what he means by arts. And he mentions religion, because he wouldn't think of slighting the divinities. Plural. Remember, for him there are all these divinities, these different spheres out from the earth. Earth is at the center of things, which means it's at the lowest spot, the poorest spot in the universe. And then every with every sphere that goes out from the earth, there's less and less matter, more and more form. It's more and more divine until finally you get to those fixed stars that are visible gods. He then criticizes his teacher. How much unity do we have to have in the state for the state to survive? And he says, Plato had way too much in way of unity. What did Plato argue for? Well, Plato argued that men were going to have all the wives in common, and all the wives were going to take care of all the children. But people had property in common, and they had religion in common, and they had language in common, and so on. Aristotle says that's no good. Each man needs his own wife and his own children, and he needs his own property. And he has a comment about communal ownership. And it's a pretty good one. He says, what is owned by everyone is cared for by no one. He wants each individual's pride in his own family, his own home, and so on, to be the motive for keeping it up, improving it, and so on. So he's opposed to communal ownership. He's opposed to communal marriage and family. And having raised the question of what unities the state needs, he then doesn't produce a list of them right there. Say, well, what does the state need and what's proper for it to have? Well, this, but spread out over the next chapters, he does name a number of things as unities that the state requires in order not to fall apart, in order to preserve the state. And these unities include, we must speak the same language. We must wear the same clothes. Isn't that interesting? We dance the same dances. We celebrate the same holidays. And here comes the one that really makes a huge difference in the future. We worship the same gods. Did you ever wonder, when you heard stories about the Inquisition or about heretics being burned at the stake and all that stuff, did you ever wonder where they got such an idea? It's certainly not in the New Testament, is it? The worst thing that the New Testament itself ever recommends is in the case of someone who's a public sinner and brings disgrace on the church, is that you dismiss them from church membership. That's it. That's the worst thing that's ever mentioned. Nothing in the New Testament ever suggests you execute somebody for holding a different theological opinion. Where did that come from? Well, I'll tell you where it came from. It came right from exactly this claim of Aristotle's, that if you don't worship the same gods, and people took that to mean in the same way, then the state is threatened. And that's exactly what we find then in what we call the Middle Ages. In the late Middle Ages, this practice of executing heretics arose. The church would put you on trial and examine you to see whether your opinions were heresy, whether they were not the teaching of the church. But the church never then condemned anyone to be imprisoned or executed. The state had to do that. The government had to do that. The king had to make the law that said heresy is punishable by death. And the state then executed people. And why did they do that? Because if you hold a different opinion, it's treason. You're threatening the state. We know that's right. Aristotle told us. And that's where it came from. Not only that, Aristotle gets that from his own teacher in the Laws. And that's his last dialogue, his most enlightened one, the one in which he advocates a kind of government that's much freer than what he proposed in the Republic. But even in the Laws, he says anyone who's an atheist should be banished. Cannot be allowed to live here with other people. So if you want to know where that tradition came from, it came from Plato and Aristotle. And Plato and Aristotle were taught to all the intelligentsia, that is, the nobility, those who ruled in Europe after the rise and spread of Christianity. That's where we get this horrific idea of executing somebody for having a different theological opinion. That was continued in the early settlements in the United States, I remind you, that even when people came to the shores of North America because they wanted religious liberty, that's partially true. But once they set up a colony, say in Massachusetts Bay, they set up then, this is our theology, and if somebody else differed, they banished them. They banished poor Roger Williams, who nearly died because they banished him from the colony in the wintertime, and if the Indians hadn't taken him in and taken care of him, non-Christian Indians, he would have died. And what was his big heresy? Well, he was a Baptist. He didn't believe in baptizing children. He thought you should only be baptized when you're an adult. I don't agree with him, but would I want to see him thrown out of the colony and freeze to death in the winter because he thinks that? Of course not. But they continued that idea that somehow the political integrity of the state is threatened by someone who has a different opinion about divinity, the true God, or how to worship. It's sad, but it's also a fact. So Aristotle then reviews all different forms that the state can take. And I won't go into great detail because you can read that for yourself, and it's easy reading. He goes through monarchy, and then a limited monarchy, and then this, that, and the other thing, and he finally comes up, he considers democracy, and he rejects that as a form of government. And I want to add an explanation of, because I don't want you to be confused about that. When he rejects democracy, what he's rejecting, that is his idea of what is meant by democracy, is every citizen votes on every law. And that he does not think is practical or advisable. He does not mean what we mean by democracy, a Western European or North American democracy. He calls that polity. That's his name for that kind of a state. And that kind of a state is one in which all the citizens vote, but not on every law. They vote on people to be the lawmakers. They elect them, and they pass the laws. That's very close to what exists today, say, in Germany, France, Britain, the U.S., Canada, electing people to hold office of lawmaker, and then also electing other offices in which people administer the law. They might be judges, or they might be magistrates, or maybe it's the president who enforces the law, and so on. And he thinks that's the best arrangement possible. But it has some drawbacks. It has some weak points. And he thinks the two main weak points of that kind of government are, number one, it's going to be hard to get set up elections and have only the best people elected to the highest offices. That's a challenge, because if you allow anybody who's a citizen to put themselves forward as a candidate, it may well be that person has the gift of gab, persuades a lot of people to vote for him, and is not really good and not really suited to hold a high office. That's a threat, he thinks. And the other threat is that this kind of government, he says, works only where there's a large middle class, and he means economic class, where most of the people are middle class. There are a few wealthy a few impoverished, but it works well for a big middle class. If you shrink the middle class, he says, and you get a lot of wealthy people and a lot of poor people, then because they're allowed to vote, what's going to happen is that the poor are going to band together and they're going to vote to take the wealth away from the rich. And he says, if that's not unjust, what is? So there are two main threats to this sort of government. Holding public elections, but somehow fixing it so that only the most able people get elected to the highest offices. He also thinks there should be another rank of offices below that to which may turn over faster and be open to more people. And then whether there's a large middle class, that will preserve this kind of a state. Well, I see by the clock on the wall that we've run out of time. So we'll continue this next session. Do the reading. Read The Politics. It's a fascinating book.